श्री गोवर्धन पूज की जय। श्री गिरिराज महाराज की जय। गौर प्रमाण हरि बोल। सो प्रणाम टू ऑल ऑफ यू। गुड मॉर्निंग फ्रॉम नॉर्थ कैरोलिना एंड मे यू हैव अ वेरी ब्लेस्ड सेलिब्रेशन ऑफ श्री गोवर्धन पूजा। वन ऑफ द most unique leelas of Bhagavan Sri Krishna performing in Braj. For many reasons, this is a very interesting leela, very interesting section of the Bhagavatam with so many insects in so many layers, levels, directions again. And of course, we can never fully embrace and encompass all the one single leela of Bhagavan implies. So we will just try to touch upon one single point in this infinite line of leela, be praying to be sprinkled by at least one single drop of this whole ocean that is the life of the Absolute in play. So today, Govardhan Puja, we have given a subtitle to today's talk: the most unexpected shelter during the most unexpected tragedy. As for those who know the Govardhan Leela, you may imagine where all these points. So my intention today, as well as a brief introduction to today's topic, is to somehow connect Govardhan Puja and today's lecture with a recent lecture that I gave last week, if I'm not mistaken, where I spoke about what shines in the darkness. Where I was sharing a little bit how I'm trying to properly navigate this particular page of this particular chapter, of this particular book in this lifetime. So during that class, What Shines in the Darkness, we spoke, I won't make a whole summary of that and recap, but we spoke about darkness, of course, but also we spoke about what shines in the darkness, how to embrace darkness, uncertainty, paradox, in such a way that light comes out of it, that we can connect with the with a particular upgrading, if you will, that is inserted, potentially present, waiting for us in whatever we may feel or experience is dark. Dark in the sense of not necessarily depressing, but just uncertain. In darkness, you don't know where you are, what's around you, what's taking place. You don't have certain normal points of reference through which you define who you are or define where you are in life. And suddenly many of those things may be taken away for whatever reasons. And you need a new recalibration, if you will, a new way of moving or finding yourself in the dark as well. So today, as we spoke about the dark or darkness and what shines in it in our previous lecture, today for Govardhan Puja we'll be speaking using, going from the analogy, if you will, of darkness to the analogy of the storm. That is a very important part of this Govardhan Leela, Indra's storm, or the eye of the storm, to be more specific, not to be in the eye of the storm, and what it represents, and also how to find again proper shelter in the midst of such tragedy, as was the storm that Indra threw on all the Brajavasis in the context of the Govardhan Leela. And also not only how to find proper shelter in the midst of tragedy, but also how the very notion of taking shelter is something evolving. It's an evolving notion. It's not a static conception that taking shelter is this or that, but the notion and the way the shelter will appear to us and we will take shelter is something in constant change and evolution according to our own change and evolution and progress. So shelter will take different shapes in life, and we will have to take a particular shape ourselves to fit into the new shape of that shelter according to the need of the moment. So all this and much more, of course, is been depicted in the in this Govardhan Lila. So in this connection, I'll try to explain Govardhan Lila today mostly from what we may call an allegorical eye. No? A different eyes through which we see, as we may have spoken many times, according to different stages of our journey. So the allegorical eye, if you will, is the one that best fits a Madhyam Adhikari, or someone who even aspires for that position of being someone who is trying to properly harmonize and integrate all this, all the things that before being in that stage seem like contradictory, seems like dangerous, seems like worthy of evading and rejecting. But a Madhyam Adhikari is someone who wants to, again, embrace contradiction, hold paradox, and try to create something out of that. Try to create a piece of art, if you will, through messiness and all the things that at certain stages we may feel as embarrassing or avoidable, at least to say the least. So this type of eye, again, of drawing teachings, drawing certain symbols, if you're taking some symbols and learning from that, has to do with someone who would like to be this type of progressive Vaishnava, Madhyam Adhikari, as well as to how to approach revelation, Shastra, how to approach life itself. That type of eye will prove itself to be very, very useful. It's not the only eye, as we will see, but it's a very important one. So this allegorical eye is implies on one side not to go to the literal eye, because the allegorical eye is in between the literal eye and the ultimate, if you will, esoteric eye, contemplative eye. So literal eye means you are going to a Govardhan Lila and you're taking the Lila literally. And literally will mean what the story means to you in your present condition, situation, if you will. Taking things as they present themselves to your senses directly. What you can see and touch, and that's basically it. So the allegorical eye do not have to do with that. And also allegorical eye do not have to do with trying to jump or to rush. As Sri Samaras will say, full rushing where angels fear to tread. So not trying to jump into the ultimate and most esoteric significance of Govardhan Lila or any Lila for that case. Because also, of course, we cannot do that either. I mean, if you don't have the Adhikar, you cannot just jump and be there. If you don't have proper grounding and realization. So allegorical eye doesn't mean any of these two ideas. Not just limit everything to the literal perception, not trying to rush and jump into a higher stage that we are not ready for. But trying to acknowledge where we are and where we want to be and try to extract relevant teachings, relevant values, relevant principles from the Lila in this case that are crucial to the present stage as sadhakas, as practitioners in our journey, whatever we may be, and for in connection to our pursuit of this Madhyam Adhikar, Madhyam Bhakti, in order to eventually attain the ultimate stages of divine love, for sure. But again, if you want to reach the highest peak of the mountain, first you have to go through some lower peaks, and they are lower only in that sense, but they are quite high in itself since they are conducing yourself to the highest reach. So we have these three types of eyes, literal, allegorical, and contemplative, or esoteric. I remember I also spoke in my book, the one I wrote a few times months ago, that in the very introduction, the notions of first naivete and second naivete, and what must come in between both, which is another way of speaking about these three stages. You can be naive in the beginning, being like innocent, childlike, if you will, or you can express the ultimate naivete, beyond the innocence, the beginner's innocence, you can reach the ultimate naivete, which is the Gyan Sunya Bhakti of the Vrajavasis, another type of innocence, another type of unknowing. That's the final goal of Gaudiya Vedanta, Vraja Lila. That's the second, if you want to put it like that, naivete. But to reach such a target, to reach such a ultimate naivete from the first one, we have to go through a crucial intermediate stage, which may not be that naive, if you will, but it's mostly characterized by integration of complexity. Let's put it like that. Why not? No, like trying to deal with, again, complexity. No, it may not be such a simple stage, if you will, as we may like. It will be a complex stage, as we say, in which we will have to deal and learn what to do with all that chaos, if you will, chaotic situations that go beyond our control, and what to do with that. And for that, it's important to apply this allegorical eye, not literal eye, nor the most mature contemplative vision that will come as a final fruit of going through our intermediate, if you will, discipline. There is some story that sometimes is narrated by some contemplatives in connection to this type of three eyes, which somehow kind of introduce us to the role of each one of them and how reality will seem very different. The same reality will seem very different depending on from which perspective you are addressing it. So this is an example of three men who were standing in front of the ocean, looking at the sunset. Very unique, beautiful scene, if you will. But with three different sets of eyes, these three types of eyes that we mentioned. So the first person, with the literal eye, if you will, with the physical eye, was just perceiving the immense physical beauty of the sunset, of the ocean, of the whole combined scenario. I was enjoying that event in itself through that particular eye, which is basically the eye of most of the people in this world, 80% or more probably, who just deal with reality on the basis of what we can see, what we can touch, etc. And that was enough reality for that person, and as it is for most, because that person didn't have that much interest into going deeper, as Mahaprabhu will say, to Ramananda Roy, Aho Bahiyai Go Kahi Aar. That superficial, go deeper. For that person, that was enough reality for him, for her. Little interest into what we may call the bigger picture, larger ideas, intimations, intuitions, the grand, if you will, scheme of things. That was not a concern for that person. So that person saw the thing with the first eye, which was good enough for him. Then the second man saw the sunset, same sunset, probably sitting next to the other one, and he enjoyed the same, all the beauty that the first man enjoyed through the physical eye, if you will. But also he was a lover of, if you will, technology and science, so he enjoys also his power to make sense of the universe and to explain somehow what he had just discovered, to draw some meaning and purpose from the physical experience, if you will. So he started to think about, I don't know, the cyclical rotations of planets and stars, and he took use of imagination and intuition and reasoning, and again he perceived the situation with the second eye, which was deeper, better. And then of course the third man saw the same sunset, same in one way, of course, because according to the filter of the eye, there will be a different one. And also he enjoyed all that the first and the second man enjoyed and saw. But also he was able to progress further than that, go further, go deeper, from just seeing the whole thing, first case, from explaining the whole thing to himself, second case, and now he was tasting the whole thing. So that can be parallel with the idea of rasa in our tradition, not only to perceive with our senses, to use our head, if you will, to make sense of reality, but also to reach a ultimate state of relishing the situation, if you will, in a deep way. And of course, that person was in awe in front of such situation, in front of the, we might call it the underlying mystery that lies beyond this simple, quote-unquote simple, but so deep and complex daily extraordinary affairs like the sunset, the rising of the sun, and so on. So he perceived the whole thing in a way more spacious and deep way, and using his third eye, if you will, which is the full, ultimate goal of all seeing, of all knowing. And that seeing was the best, of course. Somehow represents our prayojan, the goal of life, to perceive all reality with sambandha perfectly in place. Everything is tied and connected to a common source. But again, this is not just something we press a button and we are there and we have the vision. So to get there one day, to get to that ultimate contemplative vision, probably we must first go through the first eye and then the second eye. Because indeed, if you ignore the first eye, your immediate physical experience, the second eye, trying to use your reasoning powers in connection to what you are experiencing and understanding the limits of it as well, if you don't go through properly through those stages, your hold on the third eye, of the transcendental divine vision, will be often temporary, shallow, superficial, incapable of being even shared with anybody else. You can be end up speaking about something very high in a very superficial way. So, which is not the idea. That's pretty very unbecoming. So it's important that we ground ourselves even in the most basic or so-called ordinary aspects of life, and we are able to speak about that very, very deeply, instead of trying to rise to something which is beyond our reach and embarrass ourselves by speaking in a very primitive way about something so refined and nuanced. So of course, all of us need to become ultimately true mystics in every sense of the word, which means someone who will see with all the three sets of eyes, and not just becoming eccentric people or fanatics or rebels without a cause. That's not the goal of this. So today, again, although today I'm saying all this, again, sorry for my introduction, but I needed to make proper emphasis on this, the type of eye, the set of eye we will choose today, if you will. So today we will emphasize this second type of eye. That's in the context of reaching the ultimate type of vision, contemplative vision, esoteric vision, participation in ultimate reality. So this second, the ultimate eye will integrate and include the previous two sets of eyes. But most of us cannot just jump there as again. So I'm making this point also as to the importance of not skipping any of these other sets of eyes, any of these stages we need to go through. Because skipping will be a form of avoiding, will be a form of evading, and as we explained many times, will be a form of sahajism. Whether you try to rush to something that is higher than yourself, or whether you try to avoid growing and going beyond a certain stage that you are no longer required to remain in. So that's it. That was like the foundational stone I wanted to establish to begin with today. So we embark on this journey with the proper set of eyes, so you use the proper lens, not the wrong ones in this connection. So that's how we will go to Govardhan Lila, and we will go through the main narrative of this particular exploit of Bhagavan in Braj, and trying to draw some teaching, some meaning through this, again, allegorical eye, what these different sections of the Lila are saying to us in our particular stage. So this Govardhan Lila encompasses four chapters of the Srimad Bhagavatam, in the 10th canto, chapters 24 till 27. So it's that in itself speaks about the importance and significance of it. Not generally all Lilas in the Bhagavat occupy that many chapters, four chapters. You have Rasa Lila, of course, five chapters. Govardhan Lila almost there, four chapters. And this is a, since I mentioned Rasa Lila, Govardhan Lila is a very important pre-Rasa Lila section. As we know, the whole Bhagavatam is building up to the 10th canto, but then we could say the 10th canto is building up to reach the Rasa Lila, which is the zenith of it. And whatever comes after Rasa Lila is a reflection on what that zenith meant. So Govardhan Lila appears, reaches till chapter 27. As we know, Rasa Lila begins in chapter 29. So we are almost there reaching Rasa Lila, which basically represents the highest form of celebration in life, the highest form of participation in existence, through the deepest form of surrender, of love, of selflessness, of self-forgetfulness in divine love, and so on, that the Braja Gopis will express. But again, in order to reach there, go there and survive such a section, if you will, and properly understand it, properly appreciate it, all the previous chapters in the Bhagavatam are trying to prepare us for that. So it's interesting that basically Govardhan Lila is almost the last thing that comes before Rasa Lila. And it's quite detailed. There are some little pastimes in chapter 28, but the main thing before Rasa Lila is the Govardhan Lila. And we will see why. And we will see how this Govardhan Lila shows which things should be in place for the Rasa Lila to take place. Which elements inside of us, which type of surrender, which type of faith, which type of conviction should be properly, deeply in place for something like Rasa Lila to be sustainable, if you will, to have proper foundation. So let's go to the very beginning of the Govardhan Lila. So the very first scene of the Lila that the Bhagavatam depicts in the very first of its four chapters is Sri Krishna is there in Braj, and he's seeing the Brajavasis preparing themselves for Indra Puja, the yearly worship of Indradev, the chief of the demigods. And Krishna inquires from Nanda Maharaj. Of course, Nanda Maharaj is the king of the village, so he's leading the organization from the whole festival, for the whole paraphernalia that is required, the offerings in place. So Krishna is his father, leading the whole preparation of the event. The event didn't begin officially yet. So he inquires from his father, so what's all this about? What's all this big movement today? What's happening today? Something important seems to be going on, or you are preparing for something important. So then Nanda Maharaj starts to explain the purpose of the yajna or the puja, how Indra is the god of the devas and also is connected with rain and heavens, and rain allows grass to grow, and you know all the story. I won't enter into those details today. No? But how the idea is Indra and the devas are providers, providing us, and we are praying to them, being grateful to them, and we establish this type of interaction, these reciprocal dealings. And if you worship the devas, basically Nanda Maharaj will say, they will shower in you with dharma, artha, and kama. Moksha is not in the devas department. No, it's not so much a concern, if you will, in Swarga Loka or in those who want to be there. And interestingly, as we mentioned many times, that's not even a concern for the Vrajavasis. They are not concerned with mukti, with moksha. But interestingly, they are concerned with dharma, artha, and kama, which makes them seem totally mundane. They are concerned with religion, economic development, and sense enjoyment. But the point is that all of their senses belong to Krishna. Whatever they have, they possess, actually belongs to him, because he possesses them and vice versa. So the point is that although overtly they seem to be looking for dharma, artha, and kama, and not interested in mukti, which should be the higher thing, actually they are beyond all of them. They are beyond not only of dharma, artha, kama, but even of mukti itself. So nobody's interested in mukti in Vrindavan. That's real post-liberation. And they're so post-liberated that they seem to be totally conditioned. That's basically the situation. When you are so much beyond liberation, the whole thing starts to make full circle. You start to seem to be, again, as a mundane person. That's why the Prajalila is called a Prakrita. Seems mundane, but is beyond liberation. So anyhow, Nanda Baba explains that, and Krishna starts to ask, what's the origin of this worship? Where it began? How it began? What's the source, traditional source? And Nanda Maharaj says that he didn't know. Basically, there was no reply to this is stated here in Shastra, how they are conducting. It's just something that began at one point in tradition, and it was handed down, if you want to put it in some way, from the local folk tradition. So we are basically following that. So of course here we could say the Brajavasis engaged in some particular activity without knowing very well its origins, or maybe how it may have been started in time and modified in time and that may be somehow, if you want, you could compare that to blind following. Of course, the blindness of the Brajavasis come from their love. Love is blind, as they say, Gyan Sunya Bhakti. In that sense, in the context of the Lila, they may show that while worshipping Indra. But we could say, okay, but in us, that will apply in another way. Now, trying to prevent us to not blindly do something that we ourselves do not know how to explain it to ourselves very much, very well. And we will see that Krishna will cancel that Indra Puja for different reasons, as we know. But one of them could be that Krishna is canceling that way of worship, not only the worship of Indra, but the way they were conducting in that worship, their conception, how much they understood the worship. The idea is, if you worship without understanding why you are worshipping, that may amount to what Rupa Goswami calls niyamagraha, or just following something without knowing its purpose, and may not give the whole fruit it could give otherwise. So Krishna's cancelling that particular way of worship could also speak about Krishna's own invitation for a higher mode of worship, a deeper level of involvement in bhajan, as we will see in connection to Giriraj. And taking somehow the Brajavasis out of their comfort zone of tradition, of just following, repeating what has been handed down without knowing why. So that's somehow comfortable. Don't go to the Indian village and cancel their worship of the local village goddess because they are comfortable there. But if you ask them why you're doing that, who is she? I don't know, but my grandparents did that. My parents did that, so I'm doing that. So Krishna is somehow canceling that type of current. So I'm not saying with this, whatever someone did in the past, you have to cancel that. But my point is, if you are doing something without really understanding that, that can be a dangerous type of comfort zone. Without questioning how it was done, why it was done, maybe some of those elements need to be updated, upgraded, adjusted. And that requires some contemplation, some thinking. So again, Brajavasi's worship of Indra was part of a tradition, but in one sense without much understanding of the whys of it, the reason for that. And so Krishna somehow, by cancelling the Indra Puja, we could say he's taking the Brajavasis out of the comfort zone. Not them, us. Again, Brajavasis live outside of the comfort zone. That's why they are Brajavasis. Or they are in home comfort. Comfort zone is for the ego. They don't have ego. But there are many types of comfort zone we as sadhakas need to be careful about, even a theological comfort zone. You can really be comfortable with some particular idea or understanding that needs further recalibration, but it may represent a comfort zone, and we may choose to remain there, not to be challenged at that. Philosophical comfort zone, statu quo, position, authority, power, influence, all those are like different, very tempting, if you will, sofas that our ego may like to stay and remain for eternity. And so Krishna is showing by this, if you want to really participate in Govardhan Puja, Govardhan Lila, which is about to come, if you really want to worship Giriraj, that cannot be done from comfort zone. And what to speak of the Rasa Lila that will come after, which is totally out of the comfort zone, as we know, Krishna playing the flute and drawing all the gopis out of the comfort zone. And when they meet him, he's telling them, go back to your house, further drawing them outside of their comfort zone, and so on. So all this is preparing the stage for that. Also, we could say another, seeing this Leela, with the allegorical eye, we could say that this section of the Leela, of the worship of Indra, and the eventual cancelling of that, and the introduction of the higher mode of worship, could represent the difference between what sometimes is called transactional religion versus transformational religion. Because transactional religion has to do with worshipping, for example, in the classical Vedic system, like the Brajavasis were doing, worshipping the gods, the devas, as Nandamars explained to Krishna. We will offer these, they will give us this. We will offer these, they will give us this. So transactional, there's a transaction going on. That's how most people conceive even of God. So transactional religion is not limited only to the gods, but even to God. Most people think of that as, okay, God, give me this, I need that. Keep me in the comfort zone, basically. Most of us conceive of God as a big guy who will bless our comfort zone or expand even our comfort zone, providing the things we need and expand that, increase it. And Krishna says in the Gita, Artha Jignasrartha Ti. So even Artha Arti or even Artha. Artha Arti and Artha refers to those who are after not only wealth, but even those who are suffering and want relief. So we may approach God for him to provide us goods, give me money, give me car, give me house, give me wife, give me job, give me this, or suffering. We are suffering, we are still asking him to provide something, give me relief from suffering, give me. So this is transactional. Okay, for you to give me, I give something. But the main intention is not my giving something, but by the gods giving something to me. So that's a level of worship, as Krishna says in the Gita, at least they're approaching me. So he's very generous. So we have to begin somewhere. But it's more of a kindergarten conception of relationship. And on top of the transactional religion, if you will, we have the transformational religion, which happens outside of the comfort zone. Transactional religion is keeping the comfort zone, keeping ourselves there. I'm praying for that, to be kept there. Transformational religion, where real change happens, is all of that happens outside of the comfort zone. All of that will happen inside and through the storm, in other words, as we all see in this Govardhan Leela. So in this particular Leela, we have here Krishna cancelling the Indra Puja and directing all the energy, all the efforts in the direction of Govardhan Puja. Again, he's invoking a higher mode of worship. He's displacing the Brajavasis, actually ourselves, again, try to, as we use Arjuna as someone representing our actual own situation, in this case, through the allegorical eye, we can see the Brajavasis as depicting our own situation. So here we have Krishna displacing the Brajavasis from transactional religion to transformational religion. So directing them from one level, from one conception to the other, by cancelling Indra Puja and creating the proper environment for the Brajavasis to express the deepest form of Sharanagati, surrender, in connection to transformational religion. And again, Sharanagati, surrender, the deepest form of it, all of them can only happen outside of the comfort zone. And in this case, the outside of the comfort zone will be like the archetype for that. They will be symbolized by Indra's storm, Indra's rain, and of course the whole unfolding of the Govardhan Leela. Because after the storm, as we know, lots of very nice, interesting things happen. But first you have the storm setting the tone. So, as we know, Krishna proposes to Nanda Maharaj and gives different arguments to cancel the Indra Puja and to direct everything to Govardhan Puja. Ananda Maharaj agrees with Krishna's proposal. And all the paraphernalia is transferred to Giriraj. Govardhan, as we know, Govardhan means, Go can mean many things. Can mean senses, can mean brahmanas, can mean earth, can mean Vedas, interestingly. Vardhana means to nourish. So Govardhana, of course, in a literal sense, can mean he who were or it, the mountain which nourishes our senses, you know, by giving, so providing so many things that is maintaining us, Vrajavasis. You know, Krishna will present that idea. But again, go can mean Veda also. So go into an allegorical eye again. If go means Veda, and Vardhana means nourish, Govardhana means that which nourished the Veda. So this Lila, this Govardhana Lila, is the points to you, the ultimate nourishing climax of the Veda, where the Veda is pointing to the Braja Lila. And what's the substance of the Braja Lila, the mood of the Braja Vasis. Or we could say Govardhana means that which, again, which nourishes the very Vedas themselves. We know the Vedas are praying to become Brajavasis. So the Braja Lila is nourishing the Vedas. Braja Bhakti, Braja Lila, all of this is the nourishing, even of the Vedas, what to speak of ourselves. And all of this idea, the very name Govardhana in this way is pointing to the corresponding foundation of surrender, the corresponding foundation of trust that needs to be there for the Lila to happen. Again, we speak about Braja Lila, Braja Bhakti, but there has to be a foundation of Saranagati. So again, all this, the items are offered to Giriraj. As we know, the offering is done. Krishna himself identifies with Giriraj Govardhan. He himself eats all the food, as we know, asking for more, anayor, anayor. So eventually, after all this beautiful celebration takes place in the Braj, and big stocks of food are offered to Giriraj, and he eats them all, and he's satisfied with one final leaf of tulsi. At the same time, Indra, the news reached him that the Indra, his puja was cancelled. His yearly traditional worship performed by the Brajavasis was transferred to a hill. So you can imagine Indra's psychology at this point. So Indra starts to react disproportionately to the cancelling of his yajna. And this is saying that it's mainly moved out of pratishta. He was so much thinking about himself as I'm more than what I actually am, that what someone somehow, something somehow represented some form of threat to his ego. Of course, as we know, the ego is something, already the ego portrays reality in exaggerated ways. So no surprise that you will react exaggeratedly, disproportionately, if you are affected by that. Because someone could say, okay, the Brajavasis cancelled the Indra Puja, that was not correct, the Puja should not be having, that cancelling shouldn't have happened, if you will. So we could say, okay, Indra had some reasons to be upset. Okay, one thing is to be upset for that, but Indra wants to kill every single Brajavasi because of that, as we know. So that's too much. No, that's not proportionate. Of course, the cancelling of the Indra Puja was not a mistake, as we know. But even if you want to see it like that, Indra's reaction was disproportionate. And he wanted to kill every single Brajavasi, killing Krishna included. So this reaction of Indra, and as we know, different demons that Krishna kills in Vrindavan have been described by Thakur Bhaktivinoda mainly as representing different anarthas. So again, this is very allegorical, very following this second eye, seeing the Lila, not literally, not esoterically, but what is this is representing. So each demon is representing a particular anartha, a particular false necessity. And Krishna is killing that so we can progress, proceed to the next anartha, if you will, and kill that anartha, next anartha, and that's progress. You go from one anartha to the other, more and more refined way, once. And of course, Pratistha is a pretty fine one, refined one, invisible one. So in this case, of course, Indra is not a demon per se, it's a Asura, it's a Deva officially, although he's behaving as a demon, as an Asura, which makes the point that being Asura or Asura has nothing to do with official posts, but with how you conduct yourself. Because of course you have Brita Asura in Devadatta, who is officially an Asura, but he's instructing Indra, as we know, in his prayers and so on. So he's the topmost devotee in the garb of an Asura. And Indra is a devotee as well, but not the topmost type of devotee, and he will show what an Asura behaves like also at times. So Indra is a great guru for us in the Bhagavatam, not only this section, in others, that teaches us what not to do. So in this case, Bhaktivinoda Thakur also points to this lila. Not, again, it's like Krishna killing a demon, but Krishna dealing with the demonic tendency, if you want to put it like that, in Indra in this case, which in this connection is connected to Pratishta, and also sometimes mentioned, which is some other way of saying Pratishta, to... This lila is representing the tendency to think, I am the supreme. And somehow Indra thought, I am the supreme. So if someone else is worshipped apart from me, it's an insult to me because I am the supreme. That's somehow the type of emotional thinking that he had at that moment. Or we could say, even to be more precise, not only I am the supreme, but in Indra's specific case, and also in our case as well, we could say to think that I am more than what I am actually are. That's a way, a more relatable way of putting this anartha. Not only I'm the supreme, because some of them may think, well, I don't think I'm Krishna, I don't think I'm God. But somehow you may behave as if God does not exist, as if everything is revolving around you and under your control. So basically, although your tongue does not officially say that, I'm God, your acts say that. I'm trying to be that. You are not, of course. We cannot be, but you may try. So you may be unofficially trying to be God. So Indra was not saying I'm God, but he was trying to be, or thinking of himself to be, more of what he actually was. Which is another way of speaking about Pratishta, of course, and which applies not only to Indra, but to ourselves. So Indra was a god with minor g, but he was not God with capital letters. He was Indra, the chief, but not Indra Nat, a name of Krishna, which means the chief of the chief. So again, this does not only apply to Indra, this can apply to us as well. We should not only avoid thinking ourselves to be God or trying to act as God, but also we should be careful not to think of ourselves that we are more than what we actually are. Because if we indulge in that, we will lose sight of all that we can actually be. Try to understand the difference. We are something and we have a potential to become so much more. But if at present we think of ourselves more than what we actually are now, we won't be able to grasp all that we can be in the future, because we are trying, we are thinking we already are that in the present by not doing what we have to do to become that. So it's very important that we acknowledge, again, who we are and not go beyond that. And that will allow us, paradoxically, to understand all that we can be and achieve that. Says the Bhagavatam, to acknowledge your own adhikar, to acknowledge your own present situation, that's real beauty. Bhaktivinoda Thakur said, that's real virtue. So this lila or the anartha that Indra personifies here represents the opposite of this. Not to sincerely acknowledge where I am, but to think of myself more of who we are, basically. Another variety of sahajism, or trying to think of myself something without going through the necessary actions that will take me there. So the problem here again is trying to be more than what we are, without doing what we need to do to eventually become all that we can be. Before, that's real humility. Humility doesn't mean to deny my own potential to myself. Humility means to acknowledge where I am now and not trying to create a higher version of myself now without doing what I have to do. And humility means also to have a clear glimpse of all that I can be, but to do what I need to do to reach there. So I hope that idea is clear. It's an important one. So to end up becoming all that we can be is generally not the same of... this is an important point also. Because we speak about all that we can be, all that we can be. So we may be humble enough to acknowledge, I'm not that yet, but I will like to be that. But the point is that at the same time, we should be willing to acknowledge, I don't have a full idea of all that I can be. Be very careful of... while speaking about your potential, to already idealize all that you can be is this. To have a fixed, limited idea of what's your potential and trying to pursue your potential, trying to remain in control of all that you can be. That's not correct. That's not what this lila is pointing to. You follow? So to end up becoming all that you can be is generally not the same of what may be idealizing at present, all that what I can be. And so we should be, my point is, all that we can be is unknown to us. We don't know all that we can be. And we should be open for whatever has to happen as part of the unfolding of my potential. So Indra is not willing to do that at this point, as we know. So anyhow, let's go back to the lila narrative. So Indra, as we mentioned, out of this thinking of himself being more of what he actually is, whether because of Pratistha, whether because of, as we say many times, we could say one is not only afraid of one's own shadows, but we are generally afraid of whatever is unknown to us. Whatever we don't know, we are afraid, because we fear darkness generally, or we fear the unknown. So our highest potential may be in terms of enlightenment and beauty, but since it is unknown to us, we may be afraid of that. We may be fearful of looking into all that we can be, because we don't know what that is. So we are afraid of whatever we don't know. So that could be another reason for another way of explaining this particular section. So we think of ourselves more of what we are, because we are afraid of looking into all that we can be, because we are afraid of whatever is unknown to us. And our even brightest potential is still something unknown. So Indra is totally out of control. Again, totally out of a proper way of behaving for the chief of the gods. He's not behaving as you will expect from someone who is the chief of the gods. And totally lack of... totally devoid of tranquility. The Bhagavatam describes the guru should be upasama ashrayam, taking shelter in upasama, or fully equipoised, fully impartial, sheltered in tranquility. So Indra, of course, is not the guru of the gods, is not even our guru in one sense, although he's a guru through via negativa, through teaching what not to do. But he's the chief of the gods, so you expect some type of proper example through a charter. But he's not. He's totally angry and he wants to kill every single Brajavasi. So he called for his Sambartaka clouds, which are these clouds that are invoked at the moment of the final devastation. So he calls them before, in advance, if you will, and they are surprised. It's not yet the time, but Indra is totally out of his mind, and he sends them to Braj to kill them all. So an apocalyptic storm arrives to the Braj. So what happens at that moment when the apocalyptic storm comes? And here we start to to enter the important part of the narrative. I mean, every part is important, but the part I want to connect today more with our title. The Brajavasis do not deny the storm. Yeah. It's not that they deny there is a storm. There is apocalypse is coming. Chaos is coming. Disorder is coming. Perplexing circumstances are coming to us. They are not denying that. They are not putting their head in a hole on the earth like these different animals that do that when they are afraid. They accept the storm. Again, remember we are on through the allegorical eye. As we spoke the other day, they actually begin with a foundational yes. They don't say no to the storm. They say yes to the storm. A storm is coming. No, we cannot stop the storm. So how to deal with the storm? As we will see, the storm is not canceled. It's not let's try to make the storm disappear. But what should I do in the middle of the storm? What's expected from me? So I would say, as we say in the other lecture, no? What shines in the darkness? They start with this foundational yes of acknowledging the storm, acknowledging reality, and proceeding accordingly. But you cannot proceed accordingly without first acknowledging what's knocking at your door. So they are not denying the storm. As we will say, they are going through it. You have to go through the storm. And because of that, of not denying, of acknowledging the storm, of going through it through proper shelter, because of going through the storm and not denying that, proper shelter will come during the storm, as we will see. So that's how it works in life, for all of us to know. Whenever we feel the need of proper shelter, well, first you have to acknowledge what's going on for you to feel, I need shelter. So first you have to fully acknowledge the storm, the darkness, whatever name you want to give to us, and then be willing to take shelter according to the necessity of the circumstance. Do not idealize how the shelter should like in advance, because you have no clue. If there's storm or darkness, it means you don't have a clue what's going on. So probably you shouldn't have a clue about how the shelter should present itself either, but you should have a clue that you need shelter. So again, out of the comfort zone, totally. All these main narratives, and not only of our tradition, but of every tradition, teach us from outside of the comfort zone. Again, just go for a minute to the Bhagavad Gita. Arjuna is in such an out of the comfort zone situation. You cannot imagine a mostly uncomfortable situation than the one he was in before the Bhagavad Gita started. Parikshit Maharaj himself, the main character of the Bhagavatam, he was in totally out of the comfort zone situation, 7 days to leave. So the point is, we need those situations for real learning to unfold. So this is not an exception to that rule. So the Brajavasis go to Krishna, looking for shelter. They do not deny the storm, and they understand, okay, according to this situation, I need to deal with the situation from a particular shelter. So they go to him in the spirit of saranagati, surrender. Although, again, they don't have a clue which form that shelter will take. We already know, a whole mountain uprooted to act as an umbrella. That's quite unexpected. I'm sure that was not in the mind of the Brajavasis. No, maybe you can uproot, I don't know how, but this giant mountain with your little finger for a week. That was not in their agenda. They didn't have a clue how the shelter should look like. But they have the clue. We need shelter. So they went for shelter in the right direction. Open, totally open to whatever how the shelter will look like and what they have to do to adjust to that shelter. So in the same way, when we speak about saranagati or surrender, taking shelter, and we try to apply that principle in our life, we should be very careful not to over-idealize how saranagati should look like in our life. Because many times, without bad intention, but inadvertently, we may end up doing that. We speak about saranagati over and over again. We think about that, or we think we are trying to do that. But somehow all of that sometimes is from an over-idealized situation. We already know what saranagati, we already know how the shelter should look like in our life. We already have everything figured out in advance, which is basically the exact antithesis of what saranagati is. It's totally trying to control everything from the beginning. So to think like that, to over-idealize Saranagati in our own way, is to cancel the very principle of Saranagati from the get-go. So instead we have to open ourselves to how Krishna wants to give shelter. We know he is the shelter, he's the giver of shelter, but how he will give the shelter, what form it will take, we should be totally open to that, and totally open to his unexpected style of doing things. Moving in a zigzag way, as we know, that's how love works. So instead of doing that, sometimes we try to control the shelter, and we try to anticipate how Saranagati should look like, which is embarrassing. It's still the comfort zone. Still, I want everything to happen according to my sweet will, which is very bitter, just in case. Not sweet at all. So all the things have to happen from that outside of the comfort zone perspective. That's Saranagati. If not, you still speak about Saranagati and think you engage in Saranagati from the comfort zone. There's no Saranagati in the comfort zone. So the very notion of taking shelter, that's a very used phrase in the Gaudiya glossary. And as with every very used phrase, you can really end up using it very superficially. The very notion of taking shelter, how Saranagati will look like, is in constant change and evolution. It's taking different shapes according to the need of the moment and to everyone, every person, which is a very unique individual. And every one of us are in a very specific inner situation. Impossible to repeat with the second person. Everything is totally unique and personal. So Saranagati has to express itself accordingly in that same individual, unique, nuanced way. If you deny all this nuance as scenario, and instead you try to impose on others, on yourself, a generic notion of Saranagati, an abstract notion, Saranagati is this for everyone. Humility should look like this in every person, every situation. If you try to control and limit these deep and unlimited ideas to your own pre-idealized notion, you are basically indulging in impersonalism, with all respect. Because you stop considering everything as a person with their own individual characters, and you start to impose abstract, generic notions of everything. So you stop seeing reality as personal. And reality is personal. It's a person. God is that person. He's the ultimate reality. You stop seeing yourself as a person. You stop seeing other people as persons, as individuals. And instead we end up projecting a set of fixed, rigid ideas, abstract ways in which everything should happen. And everything should be expressed unanimously, without considering our differences, our particular necessities, without treating each other as persons. So that's impersonalism. Although you may not be saying soham aham brahmasmi, which will be even more dangerous, because we may be speaking about personalism but behaving as mayavadis. So this is a very important point, that this idea of taking shelter has to be dealt with, how it has to be dealt with. So, that's it. Sorry if I'm going for a moment to these ideas, but that was the very intention of this lecture, to concentrate on certain points of this lila and try to mine them, to go deeper there. So bear with me, we have a few more minutes to share some other notions. So we were speaking about the Brajavasis, acknowledging the storm, going through the storm, not denying it, finding shelter during the storm, without need for the storm to stop, no? Without feeling the urgency, when will it stop raining? When it will stop being dark? No. You find proper shelter and adjust to the shelter. If you do your homework in that way, it doesn't matter if it's stormy, shiny, cloudy. That's totally in one point secondary. So they are finding shelter during the storm. And this is a long storm. No, it lasted a long time. Generally, you don't have 1 week of uninterrupted apocalyptic rain. That's not generally what we experience. But this was the case for them. It was a long, long storm. So try to, again, draw the parallels with our inner experience, our inner storms that sometimes may last quite long as well. So the storm was pretty long, but it didn't matter to the Brajavasis, again, because proper shelter was in place. So the storm can last all that it wants, no problem. The important thing is proper shelter and proper, again, attitude toward that shape of the shelter. So similarly, we may be going through situations that seem never-ending. When will this storm end? It's not ending. And the solution, again, is not to expect, I hope this ends as soon as possible. Let's try to move forward as soon as possible and let's try to end the storm somehow and have a shiny day as soon as possible. No. If the storm has to last for whatever it has to last, there's a purpose to that and I have to learn from it. So the important thing is not so much how much the storm will last, but again, taking proper shelter from which I can witness the storm from a new perspective. Storm will be there and I will be still aware of the storm, but from a different angle of view, under the proper shelter. As Srila Siddha Maharaj will say, change your angle of vision. He's not saying you go to Srila Siddha Maharaj, it's raining. He won't say, okay, let's see what we can do to stop raining. No, change your angle of vision if the rain is disturbing you. You cannot stop the rain, but you can stop your way of thinking about the rain, your way of thinking about the storm. So, which is that new perspective from which we can appreciate the storm. Of course, in this particular case, Govardhan Lila, that will happen by Krishna's lifting of Govardhan Hill for a whole week. That will be the corresponding form that the shelter will have to take. Now, the corresponding shape that the shelter will have to adapt according to this particular storm that is coming. Now, the challenge is a particular thing, apocalyptic rain for a week. So the appropriate shelter for that will be an umbrella corresponding to that degree of rain that will, and the shelter will remain there for as long as the storm is there. So here we have it. That's the situation we are reaching now. The worst possible situation, again, in Braj, the whole village is facing imminent death. I mean, that's not a joke. It's not that only your dog is dying or your cell phone broke. I mean, nowadays that will be the parallel. We don't care for the village, we care for our cell phone. But here we have the whole village, everyone loving each other, facing imminent death. That's the worst possible scenario. And suddenly the worst possible situation is turning into the best possible situation ever, which is having an interrupted darshan of Krishna for a week, which was totally unthinkable for every Brajavasi till that moment. So that's a very interesting dynamics, from the worst possible situation to the best possible situation. But of course, what happened in between these two? What happened for the worst thing to become the best thing? What happened in between these two extremes? And we know what happened. Many things happen, but and that has to do with what we have to do to turn the worst possible situation we may feel we are in into the best possible scenario. So what happened? Well, to begin with, as we say, the Brajavasis acknowledge the storm. So that's a lesson for us. Acknowledge your storm. Embrace your storm. Then second, only after that, after acknowledging, embracing the storm, Brajavasis took shelter in Bhagavan. Trusting his shelter. Trusting whatever form that shelter will take and whatever that new shape of the shelter will demand from us. Surrendering to that. Second. Third, once that's in place, Krishna's providing a new shelter, totally unexpected shelter, as we know, by basically doing the impossible, lifting such a big hill with his little finger from the left hand. How did he do that? And then he lift and sustained the whole hill for a whole week, and then created the greatest and most unthinkable joy. In the midst of the worst possible storm, this uninterrupted one-week darshan would never happen before in Braj. So all the things happen for the worst thing to become the best thing. And again, nobody could have imagined such an outcome. When the Brajavasis went to Krishna for shelter, they never thought devils will end up in the most incredible and interrupted one-week darshan. But everything is possible for Sri Hari. So that's the type of hope and conviction we have to have. So in this way, we arrive to the title or subtitle, I would say, of today's lecture. The most unexpected shelter, which is Giriraj, as a giant umbrella, during the most unexpected tragedy, Indra's storm. And again, you draw your own parallels according to your own life experience, because on allegorical level, all these leelas of the Bhagavatam have that power and that potential, as well as all these great narrations from history in different traditions, not only ours. They have the potential of speaking to us on a very deep level that speak to our own experience as well. So here we have the most unexpected shelter taking shape, Giriraj, during the most unexpected tragedy. And on top of that, the most unexpected blessing. Again, this 1 week of unblinking darshan of Sri Krishna. The Brajavasis for a whole week didn't blink because they were drinking the beauty of Krishna's darshan. And the gopis could do that, and there was no problem of someone suspecting from them, because everyone else was absorbed in looking at Krishna. So Sri Radha could look at Krishna, there was no problem that Jatila, Kutila, or anyone would suspect, because everyone else was looking at Krishna without blinking for a week. And of course, all this was not only the most unexpected blessing for the Brajavasis, but also was a really unexpected blessing for Indra as well. This was not in Indra's agenda, as you may imagine. This whole unexpected shelter and the unexpected lesson that he had to learn. So it was an unexpected blessing for all the parts involved. Brajavasis, Indra, we ourselves as hearers, who are trying to own this narration and make that part of our life, if you will. But it is a blessing for everyone involved, as long as we are willing to learn the lessons that this Leela is trying to teach us. If you are not willing for that, there's no blessing, if you will. As long as we are willing to remain students forever. Even during our most embarrassing moments, or especially during our most embarrassing moments, as Indra is showing. Even after realizing our biggest mistakes. So, so Indra is the chief of the gods, although he's the chief of... He had the integrity, eventually, as we know, of how the narration continued, to acknowledge his mistake, which had to do with not being able to properly acknowledge many things, as we already mentioned. But one thing also that we can say here is that Indra was not able, he didn't recognize Krishna as the Supreme. Of course, he was too much invested in himself, thinking himself as the Supreme. But he was not able to acknowledge the highest version of it, of his own deity, we could say. Because he was accustomed to a lower manifestation. And what do I mean by this? Srila Siddharmash makes this point interestingly. He says that Indra in Swarga worships Krishna as Upendra, Bamandev. That's the god he worships, if you will, in Swarga. So he's accustomed to seeing God as Baman, which is beautiful, but as we know, it's if you will, a smaller version in comparison to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So Indra is... Another lesson here that Srila Siddharmash points to. Indra is worshipping Krishna's Bhaman in Swarga, but when Bhamandev appeared in front of Indra in his original highest version as Krishna in Braj, Indra not only couldn't acknowledge that higher version, but he even attacked that. So Srila Siddharmash similarly, he's saying, sometimes we may get over accustomed to a particular way in which God manifests in our life, or to a particular level of understanding and perceiving the truth. And we may be accustomed to that. We may be, okay, this is it. And when that truth, that reality comes in a deeper way, in a different shape, we may not recognize that in the beginning, or we may even attack it by thinking this is threatening my truth, my life, whatever. So this is an interesting point that Srila Siddhar Maharaj makes in connection to this Leela and Indra's misreading of who Krishna actually was. So let's take a few more minutes to go to the concluding section of this lecture, with your permission. Let's further a little bit just to pound the post, to go deeper, a little bit more deeper into the Brajavasis and the faith of the Brajavasis that they exhibit in this Leela. Because we want to become Brajavasis, to follow the Brajavasis, that's Raga Nuga Bhakti. So we have to pay close attention to what they are showing here in this particular Leela, in the concept of faith, Shraddha Nishta, Sharanagati. So going back again for a moment to the Brajavasis, we could say that a big part of what allowed this whole Govardhan Leela to happen, to unfold as it did, was the strong faith that the Brajavasis had in Krishna's shelter. They had total faith, of course. And again, that shelter that Krishna represented to them took the shape of Govardhan. Govardhan became the shelter, and as in the beginning of this Leela, Krishna made very clear, I'm no different from Govardhan. So they went to Krishna for shelter, and Krishna gave them shelter by taking, if you will, the shape of Govardhan, which is no different from Krishna himself. And that was the basic mood, as we said, of the Brajavasis. That was their unconditional trust. Like, the basic mood was, while approaching Krishna for shelter, I don't have a clue how Krishna will protect us, but for sure he will. That's the important thing. We are 108% he will protect us, although I don't have a clue which shape that will take, which form that will take. Similar to when the gopas, the boys, try to enter Agasura's mouth, as we know. They're entering to the mouth of a monster, of a dragon, if you want to put it like that, of darkness, of obscurity. And they say, oh, this is like a monster. This is darkness. This is dangerous. And they say, Krishna will protect us. Somehow. We don't have a clue how. But we know he will. And he did. So the point is, if we want to be Brajavasis, if we want to get closer to their standard, we have to develop that type of firm faith, conviction nista, firm conviction in the midst of total uncertainty, in the midst of entering the mouth of the python, in the midst of entering the dragon, in the midst of the storm. No? In the midst of total uncertainty, you have to have that certainty. This storm, this cloud, this darkness is absolutely perplexing, thick, dense, paradoxical, impossible to grasp. But I have full faith that Krishna will somehow give me shelter. That's the type of faith we have to have. That's the type of complex faith we have to have, enriched faith. We have to allow complexity to enrich our faith, and not just to have faith if everything is in place and everything is nice. It's easy to have faith in that way. It's a cheap faith. It's an untested faith. So the basic type of Brajavasi faith we need to develop is that. Although all this that is around me is totally perplexing and uncertain, I have full certainty that Krishna will protect me. And we will see where we are standing in relation to that, where those moments come to our life. So again, as we spoke in our previous lecture, what shines in darkness, here we have the parallel of the liminal zone. We spoke about this liminal zone, threshold-like, transitioning-like from one place to another. The dark night of the soul, as we all also spoke about. Brajavasis being totally thrown into the unknown. From one moment into another. One moment before, they were all celebrating Govardhan Puja, everything was beautiful, ideal, and suddenly the most deadly storm comes to kill them all. And of course, after that, interesting, before the storm, they thought this is the best possible moment, Govardhan Puja. The storm came, you may say, this is the worst possible thing. Then Krishna left Govardhan. Now this is the best possible thing. Way better than what happened before the storm. But for that, again, we have to be displaced from the comfort zone. Totally, or partially at some level, thrown into the unknown, as the Brajavasis were. From one moment to another. Totally unexpected. Everything becomes totally uncertain. I'm not exaggerating. Hopefully you understand that I'm just trying to make sense of what the Bhagavatam is teaching us. I'm not trying to to exaggerate whatever is said there to fit my own life or something. But that's happening. That's being really clearly said that. And that's the way we have to make sense of Shastra through our own life experience. That's what makes Shastra something really alive and participatory, and not just some old dusty book that I'm here and the book is over there. And we are to live in the Bhagavatam, as we know. So everything is totally uncertain for the Vrajavasis. Again, except for one single thing that should always be certain: faith in Krishna and his shelter and his bigger picture. And surrender to that shelter. Again, whatever form that shelter take, if it wants to take the shelter, the shape of a giant umbrella, let it be so. Whatever shape it has to take, I'm open to that. And whatever shape I need to adopt to fit in the form of that new shelter, I'm willing to do that. So the Vrajavasis are willing to go through all these famous stages of Saranagati, as they are described in Shastra. Goptritvi, Varanam, Rakshishya, Titibhishva. So these are mostly the main substantial expressions of Saranagati. Rakshishya, Titibhishva. So to have a deep faith, conviction, Krishna will protect me. Goptritvi, Varanam. To accept, I'm being maintained by Bhagavan. So this is Saranagati at its core, and the Vrajavasis are showing how nicely placed is their Saranagati, how much in place that is, and on the base of that they are expressing, of course, their highest form of prem. But Saranagati has to be there, because without surrender, devotion becomes imitation, basically. Becomes a facade, even can become an evasive mechanism not to surrender. You can use devotion not to surrender. Well, surrender has to be before devotion in one sense. That's the conclusion of the Gita, Saranagati. And that's the beginning of the Bhagavatam. The Gita reaches that end point. Sarva dharmam parityaja. Man ekam sharanam braja. Accept exclusive shelter in me with this type of conviction. And the Bhagavatam begins there. In that same verse, expressing the dharma prayito kaitavo traparamonir matsaranam sutam. On that same point, that the high note that the Gita ended, that high note the Bhagavatam is starting. Like making the point, if you don't understand the importance of this, you won't be able to make sense of what comes after this Bhagavatam. So Saranagati, as the Vrajavasis are showing it. And we could say that there is a type of Saranagati corresponding to every form of bhakti. Saranagati is the foundation of bhakti. And bhakti is unique. It's not abstract. So Saranagati is not abstract either. Everything, remember, everything is specific. Everything is personalistic. So how much the Vrajavasis trust in Krishna's protection, how much Krishna reciprocates accordingly to their level of trust in him, very uniquely, very individually. How much the Vrajavasis reciprocate accordingly to the particular shape the shelter has taken. So this lila is embodying all this principle. How individual, how personal is one's approach for shelter, Krishna's response to that, the form that the shelter takes, the shape I take to enter into that shelter, all that has to be unique, individual, impossible to repeat. It's not just one labeling, unique official formula, and that works for everyone always. So we want Vrajabhakti in our lives, but again, as a foundation to Vrajabhakti, there has to be Vrajasaranagati. Saranagati is the foundation of bhakti, and you want a unique type of bhakti called Vrajabhakti. The foundation has to be a unique form of Saranagati called Vrajasaranagati, Vrajasraddha, Vrajanishta, the type of faith, conviction, shelter, as the Vrajavasis show. On that basis, our Vrajabhakti project can be erected in a sustainable way. And this Vrajasaranagati becomes totally apparent in this Govardhan Lila. Of course, in many other Lilas as well, but this Govardhan Lila points a lot to this Vrajasaranagati. And this, by pointing to that, it's pointing at what's there as a very foundation to the aprakrit prem of the Vrajavasis. This love that they have that seems to be ordinary, and a way to appreciate how extraordinary the Vrajavasi's love is to look at their Saranagati. Saranagati puts everything else into context. Love itself. So all the things are necessary to become a Vrajavasi. You know, it's easy to render lip service to the idea of becoming a Vrajavasi. We can speak about that so much, tell others about that, to ourselves, but or it's easy to speak about following the Vrajavasi, Raga, Anug, to follow the mood of the Vrajavasis, the Ragatmikas. Even it's easy to imagine ourselves, I'm almost there, or whatever. But we have to act out our beliefs. We have to act out our words. We have to walk our talk. How much I am not only speaking about them, not only speaking about these beliefs, but how much we believe. Not only speak about what I believe, and not only speaking about how much I believe in what I believe, but acting out each and every single one of my claims. And how and this acting out will be shown in the here and now in my daily life. It won't be shown in some other moment in the future. The acting out, the showing of how much do I believe what I believe, comes in the day, in the now, in the daily life, in whatever challenges are knocking our door, in whatever storm is coming to you, like the Vrajavasis. Again, we have to follow that example. We shouldn't use the highest ideals that come in our sampradaya to avoid the present challenges. We should use the highest ideals to go through the present challenges. That's what these ideals are for, not just to invoke high concepts and hide in them and avoid the present challenges. But the high ideas are coming to our rescue to go through the present challenges. We have to reach Vrindavan from the here and now. You won't get closer to the Vrajavasis by avoiding any of this. On the contrary. So the now, we have to concentrate on who we are now, where we are now, what's going on now at the present. The present moment has no comparison, has no competition. You cannot compete with the present moment. No. The present moment has never happened before. Present moment will never happen again in the future. So you cannot compare past and future with the present moment. And remember, Krishna can only be found in the present moment. You cannot find him in the past or in the future. He's eternal. Eternal means he's eternally present in the present moment. He's not a past person. He's not a future person. He's a present, eternally present person. And I know that for our human mind it's difficult to do that, because human mind can only do two things, we could say. Repossess the past or worry about the future. That's the classical dichotomy of dualistic mind. Trying to repossess past, worry about the future. But the mind cannot be present in the now. You cannot think the now, basically. You have to go beyond thinking, beyond the mind, to be present in the present. You need a different set of tools to deal with the present. If not, the now will feel boring, lonely, and that's why escape and run to the past or the future. We feel it's not enough because we try to deal with the present with the mind. And that's why the mind takes off to the past or the future, avoiding the present, or avoiding the present that is present in the present. No. No. The present is a gift, it's a present. And that present is present in the present. So it's important to all the things we are speaking now. Hopefully you are not putting this in a box. And okay, see you at some point in the future. This was not for me. If you are watching this lecture, hopefully you understand this is now. We won't recognize Krishna later. If you cannot recognize God now, you won't recognize him later. If you cannot get closer to the Vrajavasis now, that won't happen later. So it's all a matter of seeing the divine now. Even if you say, but I'm not seeing him, I'm seeing a storm. Okay, so you have to learn to see Krishna through the shadow, through the disguise, if you will, through the new shape he has taken in our lives. Again, as we said the other day, God comes to our life, to us in the form of our lives. So God is taking new shape in our lives And we have to be able to recognize that and to adapt to that and to continue developing the relationship. If not, we are just over-idealizing. God is this simple thing, this single thing, and only when he comes like this, okay, he's coming. That's not how it works. So we need to find him through the shadow, through the disguise, through the storm. But again, but under the proper shelter. If we are not under proper shelter, we will not see him. We will not appreciate him. But under proper shelter, we will see him a lot, like the Brajavasis did, uninterrupted, weak, unblinking, if you will. Even that's how it works. Now, there's this Christian saint called John of the Cross. I was reading recently something about him. He will say, love, and with this I'm almost concluding, love what God sees in you at this precise moment. So again, another way of thinking about the now. Not only what's coming to me in the now, but how Bhagavan is seeing me in the now. So whatever Krishna is seeing in me now, I have to love that. And I have to trust that gaze, how he's looking at me. And I have to see myself according through the gaze, through how God is seeing me. That's the most merciful and generous way of honoring the principle of causeless grace. But many of us never go there, interestingly. Many of us do not think how Krishna is seeing in this moment, me in this moment. Even try to think about that. Of course, it's beyond thinking, but many of us never go there because, of course, if you think how God is seeing me, how I should love what God is seeing me in the precise moment, and that will be so loving, so merciful, so unconditional. So many of us never go there because to be loved in this way, I mean, that requires humility to acknowledge how much we are being loved now without doing anything for deserving that. And that means to see ourselves totally naked. If you see yourself as how God is seeing you, it means you have to see yourself naked in the present, as Richard Rohr will call the naked now. That's a quite naked moment. We don't like to be naked. All of us are equal in the sense all of us are naked. We may have different clothes on top, but beyond the clothes, all of us share a similar pattern. All of us are naked. But generally, we don't want to acknowledge our nakedness. We feel vulnerable, unsafe. But that's our nakedness in Bhagavan's eyes. And that's the price to pay, to have causeless mercy, radical grace, you can call it. You have to allow being seen by Krishna and accepting his loving glance, unconditional loving glance, accepting that in you and be naked yourself in front of that. And being ready to do that over and over again. That's the willingness and disposition of the Brajavasis. They are fully ready to be looked upon through those eyes, by constantly through those loving unconditional eyes, being vulnerable, being humble, and actually being empowered by doing that. So we need to this. We need this naked glance to be what to be glanced at that by God. In our particular tradition, going back from John of the Cross to our own tradition. How do we call this? How do we call this naked glance? We call it darshan. That's very interesting, darshan. This Govardhan Lila has a lot to do with darshan. Brajavasis have 1 week and interrupted darshan. But before that darshan, you need some other darshan. You need to see Krishna through the storm and so on. And allow how he is seeing to you. He's looking through you. So this naked glance is darshan. Darshan means... Because sometimes we think, oh, darshan is I will go to the temple and I will watch, look at the deities myself for a while, maybe pray to pass the tests in the university. Oh, nicely dressed, I put a donation and I leave. That's darshan. But that's not darshan. To begin with, of Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta will say, darshan means you are being seen. You are not seen. First, you are being seen by God. And not only being seen, but to think how I'm being seen by him. Which is the nature of his glance. Am I allowing, I'm opening myself to receive his ever benevolent gaze and then returning my gaze in kind, a mutual gaze. This exciting mutual beholding, if you will, is what we call as darshan. First of all, to But to have darshan, we have to remain naked in front of God, to present ourselves naked, to be willing to do that, to be naked, undressed by God's loving and conditional glance, and then reciprocate accordingly. So that's darshan, just for you to know, and not don't repeat this word superficially next time. So for darshan to actually happen, we have to be willing to this nakedness and to this loving exchange. And this has a lot to do with this Govardhan Lila and the disposition of the Brajavasis. Before seeing God, we have to see ourselves and how He's seeing us. Again, the darshan of Krishna will come after we have the darshan of all the things that we need to work to remove from our heart, or to even put it better, that will come after we acknowledge those things that we need to properly integrate, crisis included. And again, this Lila, this storm analogy, is teaching us about that in a very graphic way, in a very symbolic way. So in this way, just to conclude, this Govardhan Lila is showing us how the most, again, unexpected tragedy can bring forth the most unexpected grace, the most unexpected shelter. Again, if we are willing to surrender, as the Brajavasis show, or at least if we can try to do so. So every crisis, again, is a blessing, and blessings will come to us not only to bless us, I mean, a blessing will come to bless us, for sure. And a crisis is that. Something that comes to bless us, ultimately. This guy's blessing will come to to undress us, to make us naked, so we can see our own self, so we can understand that the need to take full shelter of Bhagavan. Comes to mind just the example of Draupadi. She was being undressed, literally, as we know. And as we know, she tried to raise one hand first, clamming for Krishna's shelter, but still she was being undressed. No? And then the two hands were up, take full shelter. And then she stopped being undressed in that way, because she undressed herself in another way. She put two hands, she recognized her nakedness, her need for shelter. So the other types of nakedness disappear. But when you embrace that type of nakedness, when you become akinchana, Swama Kinchana Gocharam, Bhagavatam is saying, Janmaishvarya Sutrasivir Idamana Madapunan Nai Barhatya Vidatum Bhai, Swama Kinchana Gocharam. So Krishna is He who blesses those who are materially exhausted, says the Bhagavatam. Akinchana. Or Akinchana also, Akinchana means without material possessions, but the letter A in Sanskrit means Krishna. So those whose only possession is Krishna. It's another way of putting that. But this is a very interesting idea. Materially exhausted. Srila Prabhupada translates the word akinchan in that way. So sometimes circumstances in life, God as life circumstances, come to exhaust ourselves materially. Not only grossly regarding money or whatever, but to empty ourselves so we can feel it. By love, we can be naked. That means materially exhausted, to be totally naked, ripped off from all these false designations, so you can properly stand in front of Bhagavan's eyes. So these situations where which put ourselves in that situation, which we sometimes we may call crisis or problems, are actually unparalleled opportunities to advance, unparalleled opportunities to investigate our own self, the depths of our own self. Because when everything is nice and perfect and pretty, and also when everything is as we would like it to be, generally we don't have a clue what's actually going on. We don't have a clue what's going on at that moment. We think everything is in control, everything is happening according to my own sweet will. Wait for the next crisis, and then you will know what's actually going on. So it's generally during a crisis when you really can realize what's going on, who you are, who you want to be. And we need to know those things. I mean, if we are looking for truth, if we are living in the pursuit of truth, we will be looking for those moments that will show us what's going on and what's expected from me and who I am and what all that I can be. So whatever I need to see that, please send that. That's why Kunti Devi pray in that way. We may say, she's praying for problems. She's a masochist. No, it's not that. Vipada santatasat vatatatatra jagat guru apanoba, etc. She's praying to Krishna, send me crisis, send me problems, send me this type of situations that will show me challenges, tests, paradoxes, perplexing circumstances. Because the more you send them, she's saying that in the verse, the more I have in your darshan. Again, we were speaking about darshan, apunar baba darshan, and she's using the word darshan there. The more you send them, the more I'm seeing you further and further. The more I get close to you, the more I rediscover you, Krishna, in a new way, through the storm, through the darkness. So she's requesting challenges. She's requesting darkness and storms to see Krishna more closely, to upgrade her relationship with him, to find a new, discovered, again, updated version of her relationship with Bhagavan. And we should be willing to do the same thing. And this Govardhan Lila showing that. And that's there we go. That's our only duty, basically, to keep upgrading our relationship with our source. And the spirit of that has been very beautifully depicted in this Govardhan Lila. So today I want to share some words. Sorry if I extended myself a little bit more than usual, but I felt the need to unpack some of the implications of this particular Lila. From the particular perspective, of course, we have chosen today, there are so many other ways we can address this endless stream of teachings and realizations. So we touched today upon one, again, single point of this unlimited line. Praying to be at least sprinkled with one little drop of mercy coming from Srimad Bhagavatam. So thank you so much for your time. I think I have extended myself enough. So if there are questions or doubts, we may continue in some further future meetings that we may be eventually announcing to all of you. So thank you again. Sri Giriraj Maharaj ki jai. Sri Govardhan Lila ki jai. Gaur Bhakta Vrinda ki jai. Gaur Priman Hari.